When I was starting my career, I was a grinder, grind it out, work harder. It wasn't until later in my career where I really learned more about mindfulness, learned more about balance, you know, learned more about managing my energy and renewal. And, you know, I think as a leader, how do I most effectively allocate my energy on a given day? And, you know, if you have 100 units of energy to give, where and how are you going to focus that energy on the things that have the biggest impact? And I would just encourage people to enjoy the journey, take stock in how you're learning, how you're building your experience, how you're building your brand. You know, and I think it's that openness and that patience that actually creates the opportunities for exponential success. Hi, I'm Andrew, and I'm a P&G alum.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast.
I'm Raman Segal, recovering marketer.
And I'm Ida Abdalkhani, a chief catalyzer. Raman and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know but want to know more about.
It's kind of like bringing a microphone to a cup of coffee.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Andrew Sweehan, CEO of the creative group across all Publicis agencies and CEO of Leo Burnett. It was a great conversation about focusing on problems to solve, cultivating a curious soul, and practicing kind leadership. Here's a quick bio. Andrew Sweehan is the CEO of the creative group across all Publicis agencies and CEO of Leo Burnett. He leads the agency by emphasizing the power of transparency in regards to data and balances that with the creativity needed to drive business forward for his clients. He was the founder and CEO of The Abundancy and co-founded its holding company, Abundant Venture Partners, an incubator focused on building media and healthcare companies. Prior to that, he was president of Starcom Media Vest Group, the world's largest media agency. He also proudly served his country as a platoon leader in the U.S. Army. Andrew has been recognized by Advertising Age as a media maven and was inducted into the American Advertising Federation Hall of Achievement in 2008. He has also founded 9 companies with 7 exits and even worked on the Reflect brand at P&G, which you will hear more about in this episode. What I love about our conversation is the varied path that Andrew had from entrepreneur to entrepreneur that helps inform his frameworks around solving problems and kind leadership. I think many of us can relate to his thoughts on the power of no and the advice to our next generation to be open and patient. So let's dive in. We hope you will enjoy our conversation with Andrew Sweehan. Today, we're talking to Andrew Sweehan, CEO of Leo Burnett North America. Andrew, welcome to the podcast. It's so great to connect and truly a delight to have you here with us today.
Great to be here.
Well, many of you already know your professional story, but here's a quick recap. Andrew is the Chief Executive Officer of Leo Burnett North America. As CEO, he leads the agency by emphasizing the power of transparency in regards to data and also balances that with the creativity needed to drive businesses forward for clients. He was also the founder and CEO of marketing startup The Abundancy and co-founded its holding company Abundant Venture Partners, an incubator focused on building media and healthcare companies. And prior to that, he was president of Starcom Media Vest Group, the world's largest media agency. He also proudly served his country as a platoon leader in the U.S. Army. Andrew has been recognized by Advertising Age as a media maven and was inducted into the American Advertising Federation Hall of Achievement in 2008. He has founded 9 companies with 7 exits. So Andrew, there is so much in there for us to talk about. But first, as you think back, who were you before the beginning of your career journey?
So I think if there's one thing I would say that defined me, I was the youngest of 3 boys, and I had 2 older identical twin brothers. So growing up, the defining characteristic was always trying to keep up. having identical twin older brothers who are kind of attached at the hip. Much of my early life was spent trying harder just to keep up with older brothers, and ironically, not realizing at the time, though, I was probably ahead of most of the kids my age because I was trying to catch up to their level as opposed to judging myself versus the people who are at my same age. And I think it's a valuable life lesson because I think oftentimes we're a victim of what and who we choose to compare ourselves to, as opposed to being able to step back and look at life through your own reality.
So Andrew, the idea of comparing ourselves, there's a quote that I love that comparison is the thief of joy.
I love that.
Right? It's so accurate, yeah. Right? It resonates.
Spot on.
Yeah. I think it really resonates because there's not many of us that I think feel good when we compare ourselves versus others a lot of times, right? We're always seeking to do more and achieve more. So I love what you were saying about this idea of, you know, from your twin brothers, trying to keep up, looking up to them. When did that shift for you, though, as you went through your own journey and your career where you stopped comparing yourself? Or did you stop comparing yourself? Was there an inflection point?
There was. It was well before our career. It was interesting. Once I had started playing organized sports, it was interesting. I was born in the 60s, grew up in the 70s. There wasn't so much travel teams and everything. So we had always just played backyard basketball, football, everything. And I always felt I was small and behind. Once there was actually school sports and I went out for the team against my peers, I realized that I was ahead. So there was literally a moment when I was 13, 14 years old, where I realized I was bigger than I thought I was. And I remember it very definitively.
That's amazing. Yeah, there's not many times in life, I think, that we have like a definitive point. A lot of times it's the confluence of events and factors. But when we have those specific inflection points, I think they really can change our trajectory in life because they're that strong.
Absolutely.
One of the things that I think is really interesting about your background, Andrew, is that you're leading a big corporation, but you are an entrepreneur. And I'm not sure how many people actually know that about you. I mean, not just an entrepreneur, I should say, a serial entrepreneur. 9 companies is not for the faint of heart. So can you tell me a little bit about that part of your journey of kind of going in between the entrepreneur and intrapreneur world, you know, and back into corporate?
Ironically, I actually feel the work and the skill set of venture and the work and the skill set of agency leadership is almost exactly the same in that I define my job as generally it's friends and people I've known who are CMOs and marketers call me with a problem. And I get to put together a team of smart, intelligent, creative people. Mm-hmm. To problem solve it. And then we craft and customize a solution that we bring back and create business transformation. And I feel venture is actually almost the exact same thing. Most of the companies I started were of the result of having a conversation with 3 to 5 CMOs, all who voiced the same problems or concerns. And I went back and thought, well, I know 5, 6 people who I could put together to help solve that problem. And it became a company. So I think in the work of the work, they're very similar in terms of leadership and management. I think the bigger difference is just the scope and scale of leadership, the scope and scale in terms of managing the moving parts. You know, it's interesting, in addition to Leo Burnett, I oversee all of the creative agencies for Publicis across the U.S., So, you know, it's roughly 6,000 people in the U.S., but there's a lot of moving parts. If you juxtapose that, you know, every startup was literally myself and, you know, your first 3 to 5 employees. You were out hustling, trying to get your first piece of business.
Mm-hmm.
Still problem solving, still leadership, but just at a different scale.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, I'm an entrepreneur and you make it sound super easy. I can say, I don't think it's as easy to scale, you know, to go from that first few employees up to, you know, the first 20, 50, 100, much less into the thousands. So definitely kudos to you. I think it's a very unique skill set to be able to translate from the small business into the large business. And you mentioned the idea of, for you, what's at the core is solving problems.
Absolutely.
As you think about scope and scale in solving problems, are there certain tactics or skills that you've learned along the way to help with that complexity as you get to scale?
I think it really, really comes down to active listening and doing the research and homework to really nail the root cause. If you've ever read Freakonomics, it's a great book, but you know, kind of the thesis of the book is that in statistics, there's all of this noise that basically distracts from root cause. And I think the thing that's interesting in doing startups is really nailing what problem needs to be solved. And then two, customizing a solution that directly addresses that problem. And where we did really well is when we had a narrow focused solution to a universal problem. Where we failed is where in Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes you would build products and solutions that didn't address a market need.
Right.
Or weren't, I used to, in starting companies and working with entrepreneurs, have this idea of I need it now.
Yeah.
And be really, really disciplined on who is the individual, like need, what is the unmet need, and really clearly stating it. And then most importantly, the now, there has to be some sort of agenda and impetus to actually create the buy. And if you don't nail all three, I think startups really struggle. And oftentimes it was the now that I found we ran into challenges with. Every company I started, literally to my earlier comment, came out of conversations with CMOs where they, you know, friends, a lot of them ex-Procter would come and say, what do you think about this? I'm having this problem. I don't know who to call. Can you help? So, you know, almost every company I'd started, I had revenue lined up before the company started because I already knew who the buyer was. And they had really articulated the need. Where we struggled was we'd have 20 great meetings, but it would get pushed to next year because there wasn't enough urgency around the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think the key is that you have to have a solution that immediately translates to value and can clearly demonstrate value to create the urgency for change.
I love that. The idea of having the urgency for change can clearly set you up, I think, for success. It's an interesting idea, though, as I think of startups that have done well, that have been a surprise, I think, to many. So, for example, I just want to get your thoughts on this, Bombas. Right? Most people would say that socks was not a problem to be solved, at least not in an urgent way. And they've had phenomenal success. As you think about businesses that do well, that don't have that apparent urgency, what do you make of that? Do you think it goes back just to really clearly knowing the need and that the urgency will come?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of my favorite stories, I had dinner and drinks with the founder of Fairlife.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a fascinating story because in venture, if someone had come to me and be like, I have a new idea, it's huge, it will be a $1 billion business, it's milk.
Right.
You'd think, well, you know, that's a market that's pretty well saturated.
Right.
And I loved the story in that the founder, he was actually a researcher working in ice cream and had been looking at ways at actually filtering dairy and creating better dairy products to input into ice cream. And he had met these farmers who actually were raising cattle in the Southwest, and they had challenges with actually refrigeration and transportation. And he worked with them on actually a way to filter the milk and within that, remove the lactose and add in vitamins and nutrients. And what struck me about it was here you have a generic product, generic packaging, clear plastic in the grocery store. He worked with Turner Duckworth to create packaging that looked, featured cows, looked entirely different, and offered a product that was, you know, essentially lactose free and vitamin fortified. And, you know, overnight sold to Coke, billion-dollar enterprise. And for me, again, I think it just really reinforces there's unstated unmet needs, and there's opportunity for innovation in every category. And for us as business leaders, for us as innovators, I believe it's understanding consumers, listening to their needs, and being able to anticipate those unmet needs and create products and benefits. And it's interesting too, actually, if you think about P&G as a product company, I think that the greatest success, greatest innovation within Procter has occurred in and around listening to consumers. You know, you think about AG's mantra, it was really centered around billion-dollar brands, and within that, better listening to consumers' needs to make sure that P&G products met them better than anyone else in the world.
I love that Fairlife example. I think it's such a clear example of how we can take an unstated or an unmet need, to your point, and show the consumer what's possible, right?
Yeah. I think about it from an agency standpoint, too. It's fascinating to me. Like, if I thought about that again as venture, if someone came to me with an investment in milk, I would have said no.
Right.
It's interesting on an agency side, how many big ideas die on the cutting room floor, because what you hear is milk as opposed to filtered, vitamin fortified, lactose free. And, you know, I do think there's a lesson in there as well about taking a minute to explore possibility, and also really taking a minute to think about ideas in and around a consumer context, so that you can see where true innovation lives and where true opportunity lies.
I love that. I think that's such a great life lesson, to be honest, right? Not just in our careers, but taking a minute to explore possibilities. And just, I think being curious is so important as a life skill to allow ourselves to experience different opportunities.
Absolutely. Leo Burnett's famously quoted is, when someone asked him, what does it take to be successful in advertising? His response was curiosity. And I tell people I mentor this, when they ask what it takes to be successful, curiosity is always top of my list, because I feel it's the curious soul who discovers the innovation, takes the extra time to listen, seeks to learn, and actually is the one who will define the new way, the third way, the new idea, because they're actually taking the time to listen.
So you mentioned something there, the third way. So that's something that actually came up in a conversation I had with a P&G exec on the show the other month. What is your definition of the third way?
I should credit AG on this. at the alumni reunion, he was talking about the power of listening.
Yep.
And about how we live in an America that's divided between left and right, right and wrong, my way or the highway. And for me, I feel both in venture and in advertising agency world, the real power comes when you find new ways to connect, new ways to articulate ideas, new insights into people. And for me, the third way is, you know, you think about two rails leading you in a fixed direction, and they're unmovable and inflexible. You know, how do you develop that third way that allows you to veer off the path and again define true innovation and a path that no one's seen before?
Yeah, I love that. I think it's so important for us to remember that, to your point about what AG was talking about at our most recent conference. So many times, especially in the past few years, I think we're allowing things to become so polarized, and that there's only one way or my way, right? this point of view or that point of view. And to your point, if we look for that third way, and there always is a third way, that really opens up new pathways to connect, to articulate, right, to create new opportunities. One thing that I want to go back to, because we've mentioned P&G now a few times, how has P&G, your experience in the brand world at P&G, affected your career path?
I think the biggest value I got from Procter is learning how to think. And it's interesting because I feel Procter, in teaching discipline in and around writing, teaching discipline in terms of making an argument, the infamous annual brand reviews, and and having your business interrogated, taught you to focus, taught you to clearly and succinctly articulate an argument, taught you the taking out of adjectives and focusing only on numbers and facts to, again, focus on what is. Mm-hmm. And I feel more than anything, the learning of how to think has been the benefit from P&G that I've taken to everything I have done. The interesting corollary to that, I also think one of the huge benefits of Procter is they had so much documented case studies and success stories. You know, I remember while there being actively taking every course in the brand college that I could. The thing I think is the risk of that is, in the spirit of the third way, defining, getting narrowly defined in what's right and what's wrong, what works and what doesn't, and therefore seeing the past as not a teacher for the future, mm-hmm. but as a rule book that has to be followed. And I think it's the challenge that a lot of big companies struggle from, is all of that learning, all of that institutional knowledge becomes law, as opposed to all of that learning and institutional knowledge becomes inspiration. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's incumbent on leaders to be able to listen, learn, but then break the rules by defining a new path based off of the current realities versus what was true in the past.
Yeah, I think that that is such an important reminder to all of us. The idea of using it as teacher of the future versus a rule book. I think a lot of times, myself included, we fall into the trap of saying, well, this worked, so basically I'm going to use it like a recipe, right? And I'm going to take it and apply it to my situation, to my problem to solve, instead of, to your point, really using it as a guide, right? A guide for our thinking and a way to open up possibility as a template almost, but then to kind of redefine as needed and break the rules also, as you said.
I talk about this a lot at agencies, at the agency. It's interesting. I talk about it in context of chefs and waiters. Mm-hmm. A waiter basically brings you the menu, asks what you want, and goes and communicates it. Waiters make $2 an hour in tips. You know, chefs, you're looking at all the available ingredients and thinking about new ways to mix things together. And again, it's informed in everything you've done and cooked in the past. But chefs get TV shows and become famous. And I think, again, for business leaders, do you become the waiter who's just basically handing out the menu and ordering off of it? Or are you a chef who's actively looking at what's in season, what's fresh, and what's available? You know, and again, I think it's much easier to be a waiter. You know, as a chef, you're dealing with fire and knives, much greater chance of getting cut or burned. But, you know, there's at least an opportunity to create something incredibly new and the recognition that goes along with it.
Yeah, I love that metaphor. Have you been to Noma by chance? Have you heard of the restaurant in Denmark?
I have not.
Okay. All right, I'll send you the info. They're actually no longer, as of 24, in Copenhagen. They're moving locations, but often rated the best restaurant in the world. I feel like that could be a great coaching trip for you and your team, you know, to go see the waiters and the chefs there and how they create some of the most amazing, you know, recipes and experiences in the world. But that's a side note. We'll talk about that more later. One of the things that I want to get into a little bit here is, when did something not work out for you the way you thought it would? Because you've had an amazing career. And I think for a lot of people on the outside looking in, you know, you see someone's success, you don't always see some of the struggle that it took to get there. So is there, you know, much like how we talked about when you were 13 and you had this inflection point of realizing that you were good enough, right? And you weren't always chasing your brothers, your twin brothers, to try to kind of be at their level. Was there some time in your career where you had an inflection point that something didn't work out quite the way you thought?
Oh, absolutely. I've had big misses.
Okay.
And I don't think you can not have it. It's interesting. And if I really boiled it down, it would come down to two key things. One, doing things you don't know. It was interesting. When I was at Procter, I was involved in launching what was Reflect. It was 98, early internet.
Mm-hmm.
We spent close to $10 million building a website that didn't work.
Wow.
And none of us knew anything about the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But we were good marketers. We had 500,000 unique visitors come.
Wow. In 1998, that's huge.
In 1998, the first week. And we built it on Flash 5, and only 13% of people had Flash 5 on their desktop.
I don't even know what Flash 5 is, but
it was nor did anyone else at the time.
Right.
But it was a very painful and very valuable lesson in that stick to the knitting. We were smart, well-intentioned people, but we were building and buying things that we didn't know about or understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, again, and I see so many entrepreneurs or businesses try to go into categories or areas where they don't have what I talk about as a competitive right to succeed. You know, they know more, they know the people better, they know the products better. You know, it's my Fairlife example. He had spent his whole career studying dairy innovation.
Right.
It was right idea, right time, right people. But, you know, I think the big learning on it for me was, we all knew a lot about marketing, but we knew nothing about digital technology. And again, like the learning and the applicability is, know when you don't know, admit you don't know.
Right.
And find people who do. You know, I think the second thing is, coming back to the idea of really understanding the human problem, I think oftentimes it gets misinterpreted.
Mm-hmm.
And you build something that's close in. You know, it was interesting. We had done an education startup where we were working with schools on helping them to fund digital infrastructure and Wi-Fi and access for all their students. And the funding source was basically working with them and working with brands to sponsor what was the district websites. And for me, I thought it was a very simple, easy idea of brands wanting to help and school districts basically looking to build support, basically offer access to students that they didn't have in the past. It was interesting. The company failed. And it failed, I think, predominantly because at the end of the day, the parents didn't feel brands belonged on the school websites, I believe, even if the brands were actively helping the schools. You know, in doing the research, parents would say, oh, I would love for brands to help the school and help with the funding. But when the actual execution appeared, it didn't land that way. And I think it's just a great example of consumers saying one thing, but feeling another and never really articulating it. And unfortunately, we learned it the hard way after the fact.
Now, what happened? Can you tell us a little bit about Reflect? What happened after that in 98?
Eventually they shuttered it. And it's interesting. I feel like it was an idea that was ahead of its time. I mean, the core premise of it was basically customized beauty care products. And I think the internet, 99, 2000, wasn't ready to do that. But if you think about mass customization today and basically the advent and the acceptance of e-commerce, I actually still think it's a huge idea. You know, if I, and I'd been out of Procter for a long time, but at the time, you know, they had thousands of formulas for skincare, hair care, with different formulas being sold around the world. So, you know, Asian women's hair, three times as thick and round. The formulas they're selling in Asia are different than the formulas they're selling elsewhere. But because of, you know, shelving and limited slotting allowances, you couldn't sell your best products for each individual. So I still think it's a huge idea. But again, at the time, we built technology that was ahead of its time. The dial-up, the speeds, the interactivity, the acceptance of e-commerce, all of it was just not what consumers were ready for. And I think it's interesting if you look at innovation curves. I was listening to a podcast on CES, and they were talking about like the ugly middle. And the ugly middle is basically for a lot of ideas when the core idea is great, but they don't have necessarily the adoption curve to support it. And I think Reflect falls into that. You know, I still think a lot of the core insights and the core benefits for consumers still exist. But in essence, I think, you know, when the market crashed in 2000, you know, the company didn't have traction or success, and P&G ended up shuttering it, which was probably the right decision at the time.
It takes me back, though, as you were recounting that journey to the core need that we talked about earlier of really understanding your target consumer, putting yourself in the eye position and really nailing that and understanding the contextual environment around that. And what I mean by that is, you know, as you were talking, it reminded me of my own experience. I was the global brand manager on Olay Body Care. And so we had, you know, North America and Asia were our two biggest markets. But we were designing primarily around North American needs, right? We were housed in Cincinnati, right, at the global headquarters. And then we went to China for research, and we'd been working on things for 6 months around these great new perfumes. And, you know, we went to China to do some research and test out how that would track there. And right away in our first in-home, I was like, oh my God, I cannot believe we've been doing this for so many months without understanding the environment the consumer's in. Like, I went into one bathroom there in China, and the limited space they had, right, for a family of four or five for product in their shower, they literally could fit a total of four or five products. There was no room for having different scents. They had to pick one thing that was basically an all-in-one and could meet multiple needs. You know, so again, going back to your example with Reflect, you know, this idea of customization, but also at the same time, laser focus on understanding your consumer is so critical.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's anyone who's done research can share 100 of those stories.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right. Where it's like, oh my God, we've been talking about this for months. Yeah. For months in a vacuum, right? In my business vacuum. And then all you need is just one quick thing like that. And it brings it all home and gets us back on track. One thing that I wanted to go back to as well, you know, you talked about people that you mentor and some of the advice that you give them, but I know you also have twins yourself, adult twins now. And one of the things that I think a lot of leaders kind of struggle with and work to find balance with is a career that's really successful and also, right, balancing that with family life. Have there been any learnings there that really stand out to you, or again, inflection points in how you achieved that work-life balance?
For me, I think the most powerful advice I could give people is the power of no. I feel, especially when you're mid-career, I really narrowed to work and family and tried to be incredibly disciplined in terms of my time and what I committed to and what I committed not to do.
Yeah.
And I feel, especially as you get to be senior, there's 100 calls, invites, and opportunities, and really being disciplined about am I necessary? Am I going to add exponential value? Mm-hmm. And can this be handled or delegated so that you exercise your power of no and create the space to be present? The other core advice I give people is turning off your phone and being present. And I think there's nothing harder in a 24/7 always on environment when you think about sitting at the dinner table, you know, everyone's on their phone. But I feel one of the things I really worked hard is when home, when with the kids, shutting down, turning off the phone and being focused and present on them. And I think it's interesting too. I would apply this too to, you know, mentoring people. You know, I think you're aware I'm very, very into mindfulness, but
yes,
the idea of presencing, the idea of focus, mm-hmm. and being able to be present, be focused on the people you're with, mm-hmm. I think is critical to people balancing work and family. You know, like I have a lot of these too, you know, vacation. Again, planning vacation, taking your vacation, recharging. Mm-hmm. I think it's good for everybody. And again, as leaders, if you truly are a strong leader mentor, you know, you should be able to manage your team to be able to manage the business in your absence for a week, even when you have a really small team.
Right.
So you can spend that time with family.
Absolutely.
But again, it's, I think in an always on world, and as you get bigger jobs, it's always a point of pressure. I mean, another thought on it too. I also feel people look at balance as this state of nirvana where everything's good. Whereas if you look at the definition of balance, it's actually a singular pressure point, where pressure is equally applied across two things. And one of the other pieces of advice I give people I mentor is, balance is when you're balancing the pressure. It's not absence of. And I think there's this false narrative that balanced lives are calm and nirvana. Balanced lives are where basically the good and the bad are in equal weights. You know, the work and the play are equal in weight, and you're basically refilling your energy in your cup. But it's a point of tension, not a point of release. And I think once you accept that and embrace it, it eases the tension and allows you to be more present and enjoy what is versus what you hope to become, which again, with a big job, isn't a realistic expectation.
Thank you so much for reframing that. That was very insightful for me. I can say personally, as somebody who actually is a happiness coach and a laughter yoga instructor. So very into the meditation as well, as you and I have discussed before in other conversations, and the presence piece, right? Being so important as well. One of the key pieces of happiness that I think a lot of people don't recognize is that when we're thinking about the past or we're thinking about the future, that often is part of what causes us to get out of balance, because we're not able to focus on the present and we have so much worry and anxiety about past or future. But I love that reframe of it's not a state of nirvana, but that singular pressure point. And it's not the absence of bad, but actually learning to balance that so that your cup can remain full, right? So when it gets drained a little bit.
And be present in it.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you for sharing that. One of the things that I love to talk about as well is advice that you have for not only others, but yourself. As you think about your younger self, what's one thing that you wish you knew or a piece of advice you'd now give yourself given your experience?
You know, to the conversation we just had, when I was starting my career, I had good grades and no money and joined the Army. And when I was starting my career, I was a grinder, grind it out, work harder. It wasn't until later in my career where I really learned more about mindfulness, learned more about balance, you know, learned more about managing my energy and renewal. And, you know, I think first and foremost is I think now very much about, as a leader, how do I most effectively allocate my energy on a given day? And, you know, if you have 100 units of energy to give, where and how are you going to focus that energy on the things that have the biggest impact? You know, to my earlier comment on saying no, what are things that take energy that basically aren't really creative? And how do you, you know, be just maniacal about cutting those things out? But, you know, I think, again, the need for and the benefit of renewal and renewing your energy so you can show up as a better leader, father, husband, brother. And how do you actually think about managing that on the daily? The second piece of advice I always give to people too is be open and be patient. If I look at my career, I never really had a career plan, but I think a lot of young people, especially in, you know, digital social age, have this big FOMO of wanting everything to happen all at once. And again, you know, I was 26 when I got out of the Army. I was making 13 grand and running through the woods as a platoon leader. You know, by all intensive purposes, you know, one could say was behind in my career, but it hasn't been a detriment. I think a lot of young people, you know, are feeling like, you know, I haven't started my own company and I'm already 25.
Right.
And I would just encourage people to enjoy the journey, take stock in how you're learning, how you're building your experience, how you're building your brand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you've ever seen the movie Yes Man, but be open to new possibilities and new opportunities, recognizing that you'll evolve as a person, you'll evolve as a leader, and you'll get to great outcomes. You know, and I think it's that openness and that patience that actually creates the opportunities for exponential success, as opposed to grinding and thinking that there's only one path and you have to punch through the wall to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. As a curious person myself, I can attest to that just by having that openness to possibility, you never know, you know, what that's going to lead to. And sometimes it's actually you're catapulting maybe several levels or ways of getting there through that nonlinear path. We are almost out of time. I can't believe it's gone by so quickly. I want to end with a few questions that really get into some things that maybe surprise people about you, some personal things that maybe people don't know. What is one place that you have not been to that you would love to see or go to?
So I've been to 49 states and I have Alaska as my last, and it's high on my list.
That's my last one too.
I love nature and outdoors, and I'm well too, so I'm excited to go.
Oh, excellent. Okay, and what about if you could have coffee with anyone? They don't need to physically be here on Earth today. Who would that be and why?
You know, it's interesting. My immediate response actually would be my parents, because I enjoy their company. It's interesting. I actually feel like I have a really good network and access to people. So I'm not so much looking at historic figures and, which is the typical, you know, Abe Lincoln because,
but or I've heard Oprah a few times, Obama.
I've met a lot of incredibly smart, talented people until I have access to that. But my parents are getting older, so I'm going to say that.
I love that. And we talked about some advice you have for the next generation. But as we close out here, Andrew, what's maybe one final challenge you'd give to the next generation?
Practice kind leadership. It's interesting. I see people as they get more senior become jaded. And I still think you can be an effective leader and be a kind leader. And I think, you know, for all young leaders, how do you start practicing kindness early? And how do you start building teams and people? You know, it's interesting. One of my one of my favorite interview questions. I believe there's people always talk about their leadership and management and the strength of it. And one of my favorite interview questions is, you know, tell me the story of three people whose careers and lives you've radically transformed for the better. It's fascinating to me because people stumble on it. And yet you've been, you know, I'm interviewing senior leaders. You've been working 20 years and you can't think of three people that your leadership has transformed. You know, I think for me, yes, there's promotion and success, but I think the real high bar of leadership is the family tree that you create in terms of people you've mentored, people's lives you affected, you know, and how, what you've made better.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the leaders I admire most are ones where you look at the people born of that leader and the number of people they've positively impacted. So I think for young people, like, add that to your metrics of success, practice kindness and start metricing yourself on lives touched and careers and lives changed.
I think that's a wonderful piece of advice and challenge for us to close out with today, practicing kind leadership. Andrew, thank you so much for sharing part of your own journey and learnings with us. It's been such a pleasure to have you on our Learnings with Leaders podcast today.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast or email pgalumpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment in communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
That's it for this week. I've been Ida Abdalkhani.
And I'm Stohr Rumensegal. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.